It's coming on to the first anniversary of the earthquake and its aftermath in Japan. Can literature help us heal?
You know how it is when you are struck dumb by something. You're helpless, and you turn to someone, to a voice that can give you sustenance in some way or guidance or something. There are no answers, I suppose. We just wanted to hear voices, and I think that that these people came through.
That's Elmer Luke. We'll talk with him about a new collection of Japanese writings in translation, just out to commemorate the disaster. And the FBI is investigating Rupert Murdoch. Is there something fishy about Fox?
And he bought six stations in 1985, the Metro Media Group. The only problem with his purchase is that they were illegal.
That's Marvin Kittman. We'll air an excerpt from our 2010 interview with him about his article, Murdoch Triumphant. And finally, we hear about an extraordinary magazine, Canteen, that brings photography and writing together into a unique aesthetic.
As soon as I saw that magazine, I got it. I said, this is the last stand. This is the counterintuitive sort of last punch to this cheap, feeling, thinking, digital culture. And so I like to have it in my hands.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On March 11, 2011, Japan underwent a triple disaster, a 9.0 earthquake, the resulting tsunami that erased large portions of the northeastern coast, and the meltdown of several reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant as a consequence of the tsunami. A book just out from Vintage Press marks the first anniversary of these tragic events. It's a collection of literary pieces from 18 mostly Japanese writers. They run the gamut from fiction and nonfiction to poetry and manga, bringing together some of the most illustrious names in contemporary Japanese writing. My guest Elmer Luke and his colleague David Karashima translated and edited the collection, which is entitled March Was Made of Yarn, Reflections on the Japanese Earthquake, Tsunami, and Nuclear Meltdown. All royalties from the book sale will be donated to earthquake relief and radiation cleanup in northeastern Japan. Editor and translator Elmer Luke tells us how the book project got started.
After March 11th, we were at the London Book Fair, which is in April, and we were tossing around ideas of something that we could do that was of some help in some way. And you have to realize how everyone was struck dumb by this earthquake, the tsunami, which was just beyond comprehension. And then, of course, the meltdown, the nuclear meltdown. And at one point, the idea of doing something that, A, could benefit the rebuilding and reconstruction of Tohoku, that's northeastern Japan, we're just trying to think of something that we could do that would be of help. And because we are in publishing, the thought came to mind, maybe we could put together something like this and get various authors to participate in it.
And you have a number of genres as well. You've got fiction, wonderful fiction stories, nonfiction. You even have a manga, and you have poetry.
Yes, a major poet, probably the major poet from Japan, and a very significant poet from the United States participating. And all of the proceeds, the Nippon Foundation commissioned these contributions, but all proceeds will go to charity. So in a small way, we felt that we could contribute somehow, just to take the helplessness away, I guess. You know how it is when you are struck dumb by something. You're helpless, and you turn to someone, to a voice or to something that can give you sustenance in some way or guidance or something, or just to hear a voice. And so there are no answers, I suppose. We just wanted to hear voices, and I think that that these people came through in some way to address in fiction as well as nonfiction, and in poetry and in a manga, what's going on or how they felt.
I wanted to start out with, you know, just talk about a few of these stories because they really are so striking. Many of them operating on a very psychological level. The Island of Eternal Life was the first one that you publish in the book by Yoko Tawada. This one is a frighteningly dystopian vision of the future when just a few years from now, when Japan is cut off from the rest of the world because more earthquakes have happened. Tell us a little bit about the story.
It's when the radiation has continued to leak and to pollute the air and the water and the entire environment of Japan. And Japan, it becomes ostracized from the rest of the world.
Right, and the Japanese government is privatized.
Yeah, yes, as well as the fact that people are living forever.
Yes, so this is so interesting. People are living forever. The children get sick. But the older you are, the longer you live.
You live, yeah, essentially.
So,
yeah.
Can you put this story within the context? What do you think the author here is trying to convey in her voice through this story?
Well, dystopia is a word you use, and I think that fits it. It's a worst-case scenario in a kind of way, alive but isolated. And I think that a lot of the anger that emerged from this disaster had to do not with the terribleness of the earthquake and the tsunami, which were natural events, but with the radiation, which was man-made. And I think it's a way of pinning blame, pointing to bad decisions made on the part of human beings and what we are left with as a result.
And also, I mean, it seems to me, I mean, the Japanese people are the only people who have had radiation unleashed on them as an act of war, a great scar by us, by the United States, a great scar on the psyche of a nation, I would imagine.
Yes.
And
yes,
now,
indeed. Yes.
Here the... what I'm asking is, you know, there must be an even more intense salience of the nuclear meltdowns in Japan, and that's what I imagine. Do you know how are people receiving this? Do you think, given their history, 1945, the bombs dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, is this like a re-traumatization?
Yes, yes. Well, some people have said so. Haruki Murakami, when he was accepting an award in Barcelona, spoke and said that this was the second nuclear incident in Japan, referring to it as you just said, opening, I'm trying to think of the right words here, so opening themselves up to attack,
mm-hmm.
where this was perpetrated upon them.
Right, and in this case, by their own government
exactly.
And
that's why
business.
There's so much fury mm-hmm. in Japan, because it is as if they did not know that the possible result of something like this, if anything went wrong.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I'm speaking with Elmer Luke. He's co-editor with David Karashima of a just-released collection of pieces from 18 writers commemorating the March 11th catastrophe in Japan. One of the contributions is a manga, the Japanese comic book form for grown-ups. It's a genre, Luke says, that has great appeal, both in Japan and elsewhere. The one that's included in the book is called The Crows and the Young Girl.
And it's about crows who happen upon a dead little girl in what would appear to be the Fukushima neighborhood where the radiation leaks are occurring. And if I could just read you a bit, maybe that...
Sure, that would be great.
Okay, here. Knife-sharp rays of primeval sun carve colors through the forsaken terrain. A dark mass of crows descends. the sole sign of life on this bleak scene, and here the corpse of a young girl, her eyes gouged out, a sweet treat for crows to fight over, her innards torn asunder, her body and soul alike dispersed into the bird's maws. But that's purely the physical law of conservation of energy. No one can accuse the scavengers of horrid misdeeds. No one is to blame, nor anyone left to bid farewell. People driven from their homeland may see themselves as victims. They fly into a rage, decry their arbitrary fate, then fall into despair. And yet, in view of this corpse, they too are predators. Their so-called democracy is just a system of excuses for profit, for an alibi, for apathy. And this is the undoing of all that democratic scheming. Ignorance is sin. Ignorance is evil. What is to be done? What can be done? If anyone by now can still profess to believe, blame God, blame Buddha, blame nature, blame humanity, and then pray in vain. And that's it. You know, so it's a pretty harsh view of the situation, and it's quite an indictment as well.
Yeah, it is, and I can certainly imagine the rage of it. And yet there are many pieces also in this collection, March Was Made of Yarn, that are quite beautiful and even hopeful.
Yes, indeed, yes.
One of them that I just totally loved is called Lulu by Shinji.
Ah, you did, yes.
Shinji Ishii. It's a kind of magical realism, a story of a dog that you're not quite sure is real or is not, that gives comfort to the children who've been traumatized and are now in an evacuation center.
And one isn't sure whether, even as the people talk at a reunion years later about this dog, Lulu, it's not clear whether the dog really did exist, or whether they made the dog up, or if it does not matter whether it's real or not.
Right, because this is a dog that is
performed such a function for them.
Yeah. Right, and you know, it's almost all told from the perspective of the dog, except for the very end. You know, who witnesses these kind of motherly angelic beings who have come down to comfort the people who are at this evacuation center, and then the dog watches them and learns what they do and then begins to go and do the same for the children there who have been orphaned, who are alone and completely traumatized. It's just a beautiful story. And another one that in some ways was similar is Box Story by Tetsuya Akikawa. Could you say a little bit about that?
That's such an interesting story. If it didn't appear as part of this collection, you would just think that it was a delightful tale, perhaps, poignant and tender. But within the context of this book, you understand how lives have been turned upside down and how lives are reduced at one point to box-like existences where the box has to reproduce for the sake of society, and this young woman is employed to care for these boxes, and then must give them up.
And this is in, is it in the Fukushima prefecture? It's after the tsunami, after the disaster.
She's there, and
she's given the care of a box that is supposed to reproduce itself.
Right, and then she has to give it up.
Yes, but the box itself reproduces itself so splendidly.
Yes, and then at the end she goes to a park so that before the box is given to the government, she can show the box the color of the sky, and instead finds herself pulling the box over her head. And she herself experienced the darkness, and tears come to her eyes. But in that act, finds redemption, finds some kind of sense of peace, and a galaxy is born.
You know, it just seems a story that informs the reader of the psychological dimension of suffering through this kind of trauma and then finding some way of healing within oneself. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah.
And then there are others that are less, you know, that are straight reportage, people who have gone from, you know, from other parts of Japan to go into the area to find their relatives or to do some volunteer work as well.
Yes. In one case, it's a story by Dale Furukawa, 16 years later in the same place. The narrative is just startling. He himself is from Sendai.
Which was where?
Which was very close to the epicenter of the earthquake and close as well to the radiation. So he goes home to visit his family. And it's what happens when you are stunned by everything you see, that you're almost literally struck dumb. And his voice is measured, and he's worried about the land. He's worried about the water. He's worried about the fact that people can no longer live there and that reconstruction can occur, but that the cleanup of the radiation might take as long as 30 or 40 years, or perhaps even a century. And that's just a dazzling fact to face, you know, just something so awful as that. And so you've got hope, and then you've got something like this.
The book is March Was Made of Yarn, and we haven't even talked about the title story, Reflections on the Japanese Earthquake, Tsunami, and Nuclear Meltdown of 2011. Elmer Luke, thank you so much for editing this with your co-editor, David Karashima. It's just a wonderful collection of stories, and I urge our listeners to go out and buy it, because buying it will help the victims of the earthquake and the tsunami.
You. Yes, I'm delighted to have this chance to talk to you.
Elmer Luke is a writer and editor and advisor to the Read Japan Project. His co-editor on March Was Made of Yarn, David Karashima, is a novelist and translator of contemporary Japanese fiction into English. In 2008, Karashima helped found the Read Japan Initiative at the Nippon Foundation. Here's a poem from the collection, Words by Shuntaro Tanikawa, translated by Jeffrey Angles. Losing everything, we even lost our words. But words did not break, were not washed from the depths of our individual hearts. Words put forth buds from the earth beneath the rubble, with accents like old times, with cursive script, with halting meanings. Words grown old from overuse come alive again with our pain, grow deep with our sadness, as if backed by silence. They grow toward new meanings. The poem Words by Shuntaro Tanikawa, from the book March Was Made of Yarn, just out from Viking Press. And again, all royalties from the sale of the book will go to earthquake relief and radiation cleanup in northeastern Japan. Go to writersvoice.net to find out more. Next up, Marvin Kittman on Rupert Murdoch. Thank you. Both Rush Limbaugh and his boss were on the hot seat this week. Limbaugh, because of his disgusting assault on women's health advocate Sandra Fluke. The Shock Jock has the most listened to talk show in America, some 50 million listeners every day. Let's hope that's beginning to change. But the man behind the master of bile and bombast is Rupert Murdoch, and the scandal plaguing him seems to be heating up with allegations that he might have violated the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. According to the AP, the FBI is investigating a suspected pattern of bribery and corruption at Murdoch's News Corp outlets abroad. Well, at one time, the U.S. was abroad to Rupert Murdoch, who was born and bred in Australia. In 2010, I interviewed journalist Marvin Kittman about his Harper's Magazine article examining how Murdoch got his start in the U.S. Kittman wrote that it took luck, a willingness to skirt the law, and an FCC that fell down on its job. Here are some excerpts from our interview where Kittman explains.
Whenever I watch the Fox News Channel, I keep thinking back to Rupert Murdoch's arrival in this country, and it really goes back to 1970 when he came here. He was an immigrant lad of 40 who arrived on these shores with only $3 million in his pocket. And of course, they were Australian dollars, and he cobbled together a whole empire. First, he bought newspapers and magazines, and he wasn't satisfied. And what Murdoch in other countries was always a presence. He was a player. He made and broke administrations, you know, which is what he did in England and Australia. But here he was kind of a non-entity, and what he needed was television.
Marvin Kittman says there was a time in the 1990s where Rupert Murdoch's U.S. empire was nearly stillborn, just before he started Fox News. Kittman was then working as a media critic at Channel 5 in New York when the Australian tycoon swooped in to buy out several U.S. stations, including Channel 5, something Kittman says that was illegal.
And he bought six stations in 1985, the Metro Media Group, and out of that came the whole Fox television empire, and ultimately came the Fox News Channel. The only problem with his purchase of the six stations back in 1985 is that they were illegal. Television and radio were regulated by the Communications Act of 1934. And a very important provision of it is Section 310(1)(a), which says that a television license cannot be granted to a foreign entity. And it turned out that Murdoch's company, News Corp, is a foreign entity, and they are the ones that put up the money for buying the Metro Media stations. So that was violation number one, that the FCC should have denied granting the licenses to Murdoch's company. The second problem with the sale is that the Communications Act prohibits giving licenses to aliens. Now, at the time, Rupert Murdoch was an alien. He did not become a citizen until 118 days after he had been awarded the license. Now, you can understand why Congress had passed the Communications Act of 1934. You did not want, at the time of World War II, you did not want the German companies having control of a news division at a network, or you did not want the Al-Qaeda front to be able to control a news division. So these were very important parts of the law. But the FCC, and in a very complicated way, turned a blind eye to these violations. And it wasn't until 1994 that the NAACP launched a suit at the FCC to deny renewal of the Channel 5 license. Now, this was a very important case because if they took the license away in Channel 5, then they would have to take the license away from the other cities, Washington, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, etc. And the whole Murdoch empire that was built on these stations would collapse. And Rupert would have been just another foreign interloper, one of those limeys like Robert Maxwell, Conrad Black. They were always trying to stick their nose into the American tent. And he would have gone away back in 1994, 1995, and we never would have had Fox News. And I keep thinking about that. Yeah, every time I tune in to get a fair and balanced view of the news.
That was journalist Marvin Kittman talking with Writer's Voice in 2010 about his Harper's Magazine article, Murdoch Triumphant. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to that piece. You can also find a link to our whole interview with Kittman. Next, Hot Authors, a discussion about and reading from the literary magazine Canteen. Stay tuned after the break.
These people are planning our destruction. The evidence is overwhelming.
Fox News Alert.
These people are simply dangerous.
Fox News Alert.
We're just not smart enough to realize what's going to happen.
Up next tonight, the latest fright with truth so truthful it hurts. Fox News Alert.
The former 9/11 commission issued a scathing report today that gave failing grades to the federal government for inadequacy.
Amid calls for an immediate end to the war in Iraq, the U.S. Senate passed a bill this week pressing the administration
The world is infested with sick individuals, so many imminent threats.
Fox News Alert.
Chemical weapons and
gay marriage.
It's happening now, right on your set.
Fox News Alert.
You're all gonna die.
Fox News Alert.
Don't you wanna know why?
We already know that the Pakistani crazies can design a nuclear device, and we already know that anybody can sneak in here.
What's coming next? You better prepare. Gotta stay on your toes. It's good to be scared. Keeping you posted on threats to beware. Fox News will protect you. We're here 'cause we care. Balanced and fair.
A clip from the YouTube movie Fox News Alert. Go to writersvoice.net for a link. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. You've heard of slow food and slow living, right? Well, how about slow literature? The magazine Canteen is on a mission to restore to the cultural landscape a kind of slow-lit aesthetic. To wit, the magazine's description of itself, quote, in an era of instantly read and forgotten information, Canteen believes that some words should be saved, savored, and valued. We try to accomplish this not only by publishing memorable and provocative content, but also by delivering it in a beautiful format, unquote. Canteen, whose tagline is The State of Creation, combines photography and literature in its issues, which come out when they're ready. In its 5 years of existence, it's published 7 issues, the latest of which is Hot Authors, Lit Stars Go Glam. Canteen also runs a writing workshop for middle school students in Harlem, which you'll hear about later. But first, editor Steve Pearson and contributor Rich Benjamin talk about the Hot Authors issue. Benjamin has appeared previously on Writer's Voice talking about his book, Searching for Whitetopia. Steve, you are the publisher of Canteen. Is this a project that you thought up yourself?
I had a friend, Sean Finney, in San Francisco about 5 years ago, who is running a popular dinner reading series where he would invite various local famed writers into a restaurant in San Francisco called Canteen. And oddly enough, it was very popular. I'm not sure if it was the food or the writers or Sean's charm, but we decided to capitalize on that small amount of fame and our connection to the writing community there, and started a literary magazine.
So we're here to talk about a couple of the initiatives of Canteen. First is Hot Authors, and the other is the work that you're doing with seventh graders. So both are very interesting. Actually, I thought Canteen was also kind of a wonderful double entendre for the work with the seventh graders, but of course that wasn't planned.
It wasn't planned, and it just worked out nicely. We changed the capitalization on we have a publication that has the kids writing as well, and we capitalized the T in that, and that's the major distinction.
And Rich, how did you get involved with Canteen?
I met Stephen at a literary party here in New York, and I saw Canteen, and I was immediately drawn to it. I think a lot of publications these days are slapdash, printed on cheap paper, and with electronic media designed by amateurs. But I think there's just a beautiful, tactile, old-world quality to this particular publication. So as soon as I held it, I was in love.
It's interesting to put out a print publication in this time where so much media is going online. What are some of your thoughts about that?
It's a bit anachronistic for sure, and someday my 8-month-old daughter will make fun of me for it. But first and foremost, I wanted something that would have some kind of small permanence, something people would keep after they read it. And I know it's old-fashioned, but in my apartment I have bookshelves, and every now and then people come over and borrow books from me. And every now and then, usually when the New Yorker is late arriving or my internet connection is down, I actually take books from my bookshelf and read them, things I haven't maybe thought about in 5 or 6 years. And I don't think those are things that happen with electronic text.
Do you think, and this is for either of you or both of you actually, talk a little bit about the literary perspective of the magazine. Does it have a kind of literary ethos?
We try to be very readable. My whole thing was that as I was entering my late 20s, I was reading much less. And like any man, I feel like the rest of the world is exactly like me. So I wanted to find something that would appeal to me, something that would be intelligent but also readable, not scary. I mean, I used to devour Proust and Pynchon and Virginia Woolf and all those, you know, great complicated works, and I just don't have the patience anymore, and I think a lot of people are in the same boat as me.
And Rich?
I think that fits me as well. I think a lot of people are intimidated by literature or by poetry these days because it's not immediately accessible. So Canteen, to my thinking, is very smart, but it's not going to throw you off or put you off by being unintelligible or precious.
Mm-hmm. Precious, that's an interesting term to use.
Yes, I do. I think a lot of literature tries too hard in this day and age, and Canteen does not try too hard.
Mm. And where are you getting your submissions from?
Well, we have a massive slush pile, obviously. We get probably 3,000 or 4,000 slush submissions a year, and we take about 30% of our work from the slush pile, and 70% we solicit people like Rich, people who we really like, who otherwise wouldn't give us the time of day if we weren't running a nice magazine.
Now, I've seen the issues, the two issues that you put out with the seventh graders, and I've seen your issue on Hot Authors. Now, this is all very short form, all of those. Is this all short form literary work?
Yeah, we'll have, I mean, our fiction goes about maximum of 10 pages, maybe no more than 4,000 words. It's going along with the whole readability thing. I'd say the average piece in Canteen is 4 or 5 pages.
And is it all fiction and poetry?
Fiction, poetry, nonfiction. One of the things we focus on, we focus on two things. One is the design, as Rich mentioned. We want something beautiful, something that people will keep. And the second is we focus on the creative process. Every issue, we have 2 or 3 writers, artists, chefs. Even next issue, we have a CIA agent who sort of go into the mechanisms behind their creativity, their motivations, successes, failures, drug addictions, all that good stuff.
Interesting. Okay, so let's talk about the current issue here, hot authors. I have to say that when this came across my transom, I was thinking, a little skeptical. Okay, what does this mean?
I think the skepticism is healthy. And if you react badly to it or anyone does, I totally understand. Let me give you the long answer, and then Rich can talk about his feelings. In our tutoring program in Harlem, we've been working with Elle Magazine, the fashion magazine, for the last year. And they've been phenomenal. Their editors, art directors come into our program and work with the students to produce their own little magazine prototypes. But the downside is that every week I have in my face Elle Magazine and all these crass photos and articles, and it sells. It sells much more than Canteen, oddly enough. So it got me thinking, what if we use these same sort of crass marketing techniques, this crass sexuality and glamour, to market writers, the people who people should care about? So that's what we did. We took 16 authors who we think are awesome, and we paired them with 16 art photographers who each gave their own interpretation of fashion mag glam. And it's crass, and that's the point. And the point is not to tell you writers should be marketed this way. It's to raise the question, how do we get more people to read?
Okay. Yeah. What's your take on this, Rich?
Francesca, I took it as a wry comment on our celebrity culture. As I speak, we're just bombarded with all this nonsense about Kim Kardashian. So I thought, what does it mean if writers were in this culture? What does it mean if we thought about literature as carefully as we thought about celebrity and all this sort of thing? And so a lot of these really talented photographers who are artists in their own right took these photos of authors. And so it's just this one big artistic project that, in Stephen's typical wry humor, makes comments about celebrity culture versus our disappearing literary culture, the disappearing attention we pay to literature. And so it's almost, you know, using the master's tools to dismantle his house, as it were, you know, to boomerang a lot of the glibness that we see in our culture in favor of writers and literature.
We're talking with Stephen Pearson, publisher of Canteen, and Rich Benjamin, who is a participating, contributing author to the magazine, as well as to the current issue, which is Hot Authors. Now, tell us the question that each author was given and how you answered it. You answered it with a quote. You started out with a quote from Flaubert.
Yes. Each author was asked to take their favorite passage of literature that speaks to romance or plain old sex. And I chose a passage from Flaubert that spoke to my sense of both literature and sex. I spoke about the nostalgia of traveling and seeing ruins and thinking of old lovers. And I chose that passage because it's a mean, brutal contrast to, I guess, the sex and texting and Facebooking that we see these days, you know, I guess the brute, crass sexuality we can see with digital media.
So in a way, you're making a point in your piece that's similar to the point of the whole volume.
Yeah, very much so. I chose a passage from Flaubert where Eugene is traveling and then he encounters an old lover. And I contrasted it to a really graphic email sexting that I once received. This is from Sentimental Education, as you mentioned, by Gustave Flaubert. He traveled. He came to know the melancholy of the steamboat, the cold awakening in the tent, the tedium of landscapes and ruins, the bitterness of interrupted friendship. He returned. He went into society and he had other lovers. But the ever-present memory of the first made them insipid, and besides, the violence of desire, the very flower of feeling, had withered, and his intellectual ambitions dwindled. He endured the idleness of his mind and the inertia of his heart. Mm. So not only does that remind me of romance and sex, it reminds me of literature. And then I contrast that with an email message I received once.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're about to hear Rich Benjamin read the whole passage of his piece for the Hot Authors issue of Canteen.
Okay, so this is the piece I contributed to Canteen's issue. The anticipation building to Frederick's reunion with Madame Arnoux is my favorite sexual moment in all of literature. This passage, so elegiac and concise, arouses my own longing for words and for senses. Now I suffer a world of dissipating sentience, dissipating sagacity, dissipating paper. The other day I received the following text. "Nice to meet you!" Exclamation point, exclamation point. "We could have had a redonkulously hot sex tonight. I'm going to go home and masturbate, thinking of us f***ing." I am neither flattered nor intrigued. Frederick's longing cannot be captured by a Kindle, a tweet, a Facebook post, a text. I'll wonder if ever I'll fall in love so madly as I did as a youth, traveling through Europe's epic vistas and tattered monuments, reading, 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 in and out of romance.
You know, that really made me think about, recently I discovered the letters that were written to my mother's first husband, not my father. This was before me. My mother's first husband, during World War II, he wrote her a letter at least every day, sometimes two or three times a day. Passionate, passionate letters, descriptive adoration, something that is unimaginable at this time.
It is, Francesca. You mean to tell me these people didn't text each other? These abbreviated, crass sexual message, you know, what they call sexting. But it's true. I also cherish the letters I received as a freshman in college. I was studying abroad. And, you know, when you're forced to put pen to paper, when you're forced to communicate your romantic interior life, it's just a different effect than young people have these days.
And so this kind of comes back to the theme of this issue, Hot Authors. You're taking this cultural transference of celebrity from literature. You can't say writers, because they're certainly celebrity writers, you know, to celebrity in general, and trying to bring the focus back to writing. So unpack this a little bit for us here. You know, there are celebrity authors, and yet you're really making a different point about writing here.
I'm not sure my point was as subtle as you're thinking right now. I was thinking back to the times when Norman Mailer would punch out Gore Vidal on national TV, and it would make headlines in every newspaper. Everything Hemingway did was recorded. People cared. I don't think writers, even famous ones today, occupy the center of cultural discourse the way they once did. So I'm imagining a world in which they do, or imagining ways to get that back.
And why do you think that happened?
Rich is smarter than me. He might have a better answer than me.
First of all, that's so not true. For me, the problem isn't really that authors aren't celebrities as much. For me, I took it to mean that because writers aren't celebrities, we're reading less. So for me, the problem is with reading and readers so much as it is with authors. Although I would love to get punched by Norman Mailer if he were still alive.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm positive.
It puts me in mind also of before the Second World War, poets were cultural heroes.
Right. For me, that means that people are reading less poetry. People are intimidated by poetry. And so to me, it's all about reading and readership more than it is about the celebrity of authors per se. That being said, people should pick up this issue because it's worth the photography alone. I think Stevens is understating how beautiful his photographers are and how beautiful their art are. And the photography itself is worth this issue.
Steve Pearson says, "Authors were eager to answer the call for contributions to this issue.
Usually when we solicit reasonably big-name authors such as Rich for pieces for Canteen, I'd say about 1 in 4 accept our solicitation. This time we solicited 18 authors and got 16 yes responses, which was phenomenal."
They all want to write about sex and desire.
Yeah. How do you pass that up, Francesca? How do you pass up the opportunity to tell your favorite sexual passage and to think about sex and desire in our culture?
Now, talking about reading, let's talk a little bit about the work that you're doing with seventh graders up in Harlem. And Rich, are you involved with that as well?
Not nearly as much as Stephen, but I've taught once.
So how did this project get started, and tell us about it?
Well, there's a after-school program in Harlem on 115th Street called Street Squash. And oddly enough, it combines squash, the sport. Every day the students go there from 3 until 5:30, and they play an hour of squash and then do an hour and a half of academic tutoring. And we go up there once a week for an hour and a half and teach writing to the students. And I know so many writers in New York, because you can't live in New York and not know writers. And they all seem to have one thing in common, which is they have lots of free time. So I abuse that.
And what was your experience up there, Rich?
Personally, it was inspiring. And I say that because I got to spend my Friday afternoon with Stephen and another writer we know who teach there regularly. And, you know, just to spend time with the kids, to talk to them about writing, to talk to them about academics, was inspiring because, you know, we live in a world where the city's cutting budgets, which means they're cutting art programs. And I just feel that kids in public schools are getting shafted, frankly. And, you know, it's just, to me, just that opportunity to be helpful for however short amount of time.
Now, I read a couple of the issues with the kids, and I was struck, one, by, yes, how beautiful the magazines are. But I was also struck by so much of what I felt permeated the imagery and the content of them. Some of it made me feel pretty uncomfortable. There was a lot of talk about brands and branding and material things and violence. It really seemed to dominate the literary output of these kids. What's your take on that? And what are some of, do you challenge that at all with them?
We challenge it, but it's so thoroughly ingrained in them. What we publish in the student issue, we don't filter it. We think it's better for our readers to have a more accurate idea of what's happening in these students' lives and what they're feeling. But their life is not easy. I mean, the lives of any 12-year-old isn't easy, but I think theirs especially. I know New York is getting safer, but there's violence everywhere in their neighborhood, and I think they retreat away from that by simply playing video games all day. And that's actually the one form of censorship we've had to, after 4 years of teaching, implement, is that they're not allowed to write about video games anymore, because any topic you can come up in the whole world of writing, they can find a way to revolve it around video games.
And yet it seemed that a lot of the content, it were fantasies that come straight out of video games, fantasies of mayhem and murder. And I wondered if this was 12-year-old bravado, or is this really reflective of where kids are today, or some combination? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, now that you mention that, Francesca, as I said, I don't go there obviously nearly as often as Stephen does, but when I did go, one of the most memorable moments was when a young girl answered a question by referring to a family member being incarcerated. And so my suspicion is some degree, some of it is coming from firsthand real experience.
And a lot of anger.
A lot of anger. And some of it, I'm sure, is bravado. 12-year-olds have bravado, and particularly 12-year-olds in their socioeconomic category need to have bravado, or else they get picked on. But some of it is actually real. We've had students and some really smart students removed from the program for getting into fights. For a 12-year-old girl broke another girl's jaw in school and had to go to some sort of juvenile facility. So these issues are real. It's not simply bravado.
You're hearing an interview I did last year with Steve Pearson of the magazine Canteen and with Richard Benjamin, who contributed to the issue Hot Authors. So are you using then these classes to explore more deeply some of these dominant issues, things like commercialism, things like violence, focus on appearance, or is it just kind of a way to allow kids to express whatever they want to express?
I think there are 3 points, and that's probably the third point on the list. The first one is to get them to write a little bit better. I don't think they're taught to write well in schools. I don't think they care to write well. I think they're scared of writing. So the first point is to get them to think of writing as something that can actually be enjoyable. And if they enjoy it, they'll be motivated to become better writers. And obviously being able to write well opens up a whole new world of opportunity. The second point is to have an outlet for their whatever they're feeling. So we have lots of personal essay type assignments. And I don't think a lot of them otherwise have an outlet for these feelings. And the third point is to try to explore where these things are coming from, social issues and such. But I think the other two are more immediate in our concerns.
Do you have any thoughts on kind of the dominance of these issues? I mean, you only taught one class, but I just wondered if you had something to add to that.
Well, I also wanted to add, that's all being said, in my experience, the kids were delightful. I mean, they just were funny, thoughtful, rowdy, energetic, and, you know, they, even after school, this is extracurricular. It's not like they're getting paid for this. And, you know, they were there. They were fully present and into it and learning and full of questions and full of comments. And so, yes, you know, I did hear stories of violence and mayhem, but the kids were also delightful.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I feel like this is coming across as a little bit too lugubrious. And, you know, certainly these issues are real and we're there for a reason, but for the most part, these kids are great. They're funny. They're witty, as Rich said. They're just brilliantly insightful at times. They say things that you wouldn't expect and wouldn't think, and they're smart and funny, and there is a lot to be happy about and optimistic about.
Yeah, and you can see that, I have to say, from the photographs. I mean, these kids are clearly having a lot of fun. So that wasn't my purpose, was to make this lugubrious, but to say, you know, this is a window into the preoccupations, the thinking, the, you know, and it made me realize in a way that I think this culture has colonized everybody, of course, but maybe even more so colonized, you know, a culture of violence and commercialism that has even more so colonized people who are struggling, you know, when the problems of communities of color are so great because of the position that society has put people in. It is ironic that the fantasies of, you know, of commercialism and the kind of the video game responses are the ones that are so dominant. It made me feel like, what are the schools teaching these kids? What is happening to counter this kind of cultural, you know, imperialism?
I'm not sure what's taught in the public schools, but I sense the same way that you do. And, you know, I worry that if schools these days are teaching to standardized tests, how do you measure standardized tests and quote-unquote metrics? Obviously, that's important. You want kids who can read and write and spell and do math and do science. But I totally agree. I don't think there's a critical response to, you know, the violent consumer culture that these kids are immersed in, especially, as you imply, because of who they are. And so, you know, my sense is that's totally lacking.
Well, I don't want to demean public schools in general, because I'm sure there are thousands of phenomenal teachers who are trying their damnedest to affect positive change. But to Rich's point, I think there is a lot of teaching the standardized tests, which has, you know, I'm not an expert, but the benefits that I see in the classroom are marginal. And I think the students constantly have people tell them what not to do. You know, don't play video games, don't go out at night, you know, don't be violent. But I don't see what sort of positive message is replacing that, what sort of positive activities are being promoted.
Yeah, I think that was my question. And of course, I'd be the last person to down the public schools. I think the teaching to the test is part of the attempts to destroy the public schools instead of support them. Anything else that either of you would like to say about Canteen, this magazine? Let's just go back to that.
I think it's, well, I hate being self-promotional. there are so many great literary magazines out there. I don't think we're another great literary magazine. I think we try to do something a little bit different. We combine the photography world with the writing world, and I think in a very interesting way. I think the interplay makes us interesting. I think essays into the creative process are fascinating. Poe Bronson, the writer, wrote something for us about, he wrote the book about how to change your life, and he got into a long email exchange with a reader who said the book inspired him to commit suicide. So it's a series of communications back and forth between them, and the resolution is quite interesting. So these little stories into why people create, what goes on behind the scenes, I think are really fascinating.
Well, Francesca, I bloody love it. I love Canteen. And what interests me is the almost tagline to Canteen is the state of creation. And I think that's perfect. Canteen is about the state of creation. In a world where everything is so Photoshopped, so slapdash, so hurried, so cheap, feeling, looking, thinking, and sounding, Canteen's smart. And it's great to hold. It's great to look at. It's thoughtful. And I like it. As soon as I saw that magazine, I got it. I said, this is the last stand. This is the counterintuitive sort of last punch to this cheap feeling, thinking, digital culture. And so I like to have it in my hands.
That's great. Well, we've been talking with Rich Benjamin and Steve Pearson about the not so new, but the literary magazine. It's been around for 5 years, Canteen. Thanks so much to both of you for talking with Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
Thanks so much, Francesca.
You can get the issue Hot Authors by going to the Canteen website and even download it in a digital edition for the iPad. You can also order previous print editions of the magazine. Find the link at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.